Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archives. This is Media Network, Radio Netherlands Communications Magazine. My name's Jonathan Marks, and today we'll be looking at the present and the past. Baker Street in central London was a rather special address just over four decades ago. During the Second World War, it was the operations centre for one of the most secret organisations in the Allied war machinery. Different services called it by different names. In fact, it was all SOE, the Special Operations Executive. Essentially, its aim was to communicate with and support the resistance and partisan groups fighting in Nazi-occupied Europe. Its mission was subversion, sabotage, training, though not intelligence gathering. Now that the 40 years required by the British Official Secrets Act have passed, those who were involved on both sides of the North Sea and Channel are starting to look back publicly. At the recent annual meeting of the Dutch National Amateur Radio Society, the VERON, one of the guest lecturers was John Brown, an engineer with the Special Operations Executive during the war, and the man responsible for designing a number of the small, compact, secret transmitters and receivers for use by agents in occupied territory. That included Holland. As a preview to a series we're planning next year on clandestine communications in wartime, we asked John Brown to paint a picture of the situation then. Like now, there was a sunspot minimum during the war years, and with few sunspots, reception on shortwave suffered. But did this cause problems?
That hardly affected us in communications between England and Europe. The sunspot only affected very long-distance communications, for example, out to Burma, to Yugoslavia, and so on. But we had few problems in communication to Europe, except, of course, the problem of the portability of the equipment and the difficulties of operating from occupied territory, especially in towns and cities and in villages where everyone knows everyone.
Now, you designed a number of the receivers that were used by the resistance, I believe the Dutch resistance, but also in other parts of Europe.
Yes, there were two ranges of sets, the A sets, low power, and the B sets, which were higher power. A sets were about 4 or 5 watts in power. The B sets were 16 to 20 watts. But also the B sets had a much wider frequency range so that we could use the long skip ionospheric reflection for communications up to more than 2,000 kilometres.
Now, I can imagine you had two major problems, one being power in occupied territory, getting batteries, and the second, the fact that you didn't yet have the transistor.
True. Radio sets in those days required quite a lot of power, far more than a small transistor set requires. We had a lot of problems. First of all, battery supply was a big problem, so we had to use mains wherever possible. In France, the mains were AC, but in Denmark, the mains were direct current, and in country districts, there were no mains at all. So the sets had to be operated from 6-volt accumulators used in motor cars.
What about getting the high voltage, though, for the valves?
Well, the high voltage was produced usually by vibrator packs, which chopped up the low voltage and transformed it to high voltage up to 500 volts for the valves. SOE sets were essentially paramilitary. I was told the sets which I was designing had to be used by the resistance, not only by so-called spies and secret agents working in town, but also by the Maquis, by the partisans working out in the open, working in the mountains and in the forests, and later on in the Far East, in jungle conditions. So we had essentially a paramilitary role.
Uitgroot aan veel op muren. Voor vaderland en vastgevoel. Voor vlammende vrijheidsvuren.
Broadcasts from Britain to occupied Europe were heavily jammed by the Nazis, but other parts of the dial where secret agents operated were not interfered with, deliberately. Both sides were listening when a clandestine transmitter came on the air. But were the airwaves as crowded as they are today?
Well, they were certainly extremely crowded with a very great many stations, but these were mostly military and naval stations. We didn't have then the great high-power propaganda stations which you have today broadcasting with megawatts. The sets of that time don't perform very well under present-day conditions where the band is full of very high-power stations. They were state-of-the-art at the time, and the art has changed.
You had to use Morse, presumably, didn't you?
Yes, communication was only by Morse, and all the Morse code was also encoded into cipher. So the operators used only Morse code. We used speech, telephony, only in the S-phone, which was designed specially for communication between the ground and an aircraft. There it was speech. And this had a special advantage that the man in the aeroplane could even recognise the voice of the man on the ground.
But can you do the same thing with Morse? Is there sort of Morse fingerprint?
Oh, yes. A man's Morse sending is as distinctive as his handwriting. And if we take a sufficiently large sample of the Morse sent by any human operator using a straight key, then we can make an absolutely infallible identification, sufficient even that the man's state of mind, if he is nervous or depressed, it shows up in his Morse, just as it would show up in his handwriting. Morse is a rhythmic form of communication. It's rather like music, so that the sending of Morse, dots and dashes, is one of timing. And the very small variations in timing, some characteristic variations from one letter to another, for example, a man might send a rather long dash, da-da-da-da. So his Morse would be characterised by a rather long dash, but only in certain letters ending with a dash, you see. This is an intimate thing. One gets to know the other man's Morse just as one gets to know his voice on the telephone.
What about the problem of making your equipment portable? Because I can imagine that if you're trying to move valves around as well, there's the danger that they might get broken, and therefore you've got to use only a certain number of valves.
Well, we used a minimum of valves, but we used valves of a very rugged type, and we had remarkably few valve failures during the war. Particularly, a lot of our sets used valves which had been developed for car radio, and as you know, the vibration in a pre-war car was rather high. Packing was minimal. The packaging was made so that the equipment could be carried around by hand in a suitcase. The sets were pretty tough. We used steel, thin sheet steel, ribbed and corrugated and bent so as to be very strong and flexible and to withstand dropping by parachute. In the case of the MCR-1 receiver, we used the biscuit tin as a convenient method of packaging because it kept biscuits fresh, so it could keep radio sets fresh, and the tin was cheap and it could be sealed by solder or by tape.
Whilst most of the A and B sets were both a transmitter and a receiver in one, simple shortwave receivers were also dropped into occupied territory.
Propaganda sets was one name for it. You see, the Germans had confiscated practically all the receivers which they could find, which were capable of receiving BBC medium, long and shortwave programmes. And, of course, it was an offence even to have a receiver. And because of that, we had to provide small receivers so that people would still know not only that there's a war going on, but they could hear the British news. And so the propaganda which went back from the BBC through the resistance networks to the people in the street. That was one important part. But we also needed these little receivers to communicate directly to the resistance groups those special coded messages which went up from the BBC.
Het eerste bericht is van Bob voor Jan. Alles is in orde. Ik kom zo spoedig mogelijk. Ik herhaal een bericht.
This was much better than any form of code. Little poems, little phrases were used by the BBC to convey messages to the resistance, and this was what was used to call the resistance into action at D-Day.
You see a lot of equipment that's still around, for example, the transmitters and the receivers. What about the antennas that were used?
Well, the antennas used then were very simple. Mostly it was just a coil of wire. At that time, the open wire aerial was standard. The simple reason that since we used a wide range of frequencies, it was impossible to have a cut-to-length resonant wire. Also, the operator had to use whatever circumstances permitted, up in the loft under the roof, a tree in the garden. In extreme cases where there was no other means of support, he just laid the wire on the ground.
The American OSS made similar receivers and transmitters for use in the Far East, and amateurs also had a go in Europe.
The shortage of British SOE sets led many amateurs and radio operators in Norway and Denmark and Holland to make their own. So there were very many amateur versions of SOE sets built in occupied countries. And, of course, the Germans had their own suitcase sets, clandestine radios, which they, rather late in the war, began to make.
Did they try and pass them off as your equipment, or was it a completely different operation?
Oh, there was no possibility of disguising one set from another. I mean, a British set was uniquely British because of the component parts, and the German sets were also recognisable.
In the Netherlands, a number of private collectors have specialised in this field of wartime clandestine radio. Expeditions have been organised here using the original restored wartime equipment, this time, of course, on the amateur radio bands, with contacts achieved to up to 2,000 miles, not bad for a few watts. Only recently, both the British engineers and their wartime opposite numbers in Berlin were able to meet, only to discover that they were sharing similar problems 40 years ago. There were also a few narrow escapes.
During the war, there were very many people on the move, refugees, people going from one town to another, most of them carrying suitcases and bags of all kinds for their belongings. So suitcases in bus stations and railway stations were commonplace, and it frequently happened that there were checks made. Now, one story told to me by a Danish operator was of the time when, carrying an SOE set in a suitcase, he approached a German checkpoint. He was very anxious. He saw a young boy, about 14, 15 years of age, also carrying a battered old suitcase, and he suggested to the boy that they should swap suitcases and then, on the other side of the checkpoint, return them to each other, for which he would offer the boy some reward. So, fortunately, both of them got through the checkpoint without having their suitcases opened and examined. And when they exchanged the suitcases again on the other side of the barrier, and the agent said, "Thank you very much," the boy said, "Well, I'm so glad that you took my case, because, you see, my case has got two guns in it."
Back to the present. And as we head into winter, let's cross to windy but warmer Invercargill, New Zealand, where Arthur Cushion has some listening tips for us.
Daylight time has amounted to some time changes here in the south, and some Australian states are on daylight time. That's New South Wales, Victoria and Tasmania, 11 hours ahead of UTC. South Australia, 10 and a half hours ahead of UTC. The only program to be affected in Australia is ABC Melbourne, the internal service, and that's operating on the frequencies of 6150, 9680, 11880 and 15230 kHz, and those broadcasts, of course, will be heard 1 hour earlier. Brazil is the latest country to adopt daylight time up to February the 28th, and stations heard opening 1 hour earlier, and in the 49-metre band, frequency changes are evident, and 6170 now used instead of 6165 by Radio Cultura, Sao Paulo, seems to be a move for better reception in this area, while in the 90-metre band, 15200 kHz, heard with soccer at 2100 on Sundays, has yet to be identified. The Cook Islands also on daylight time, and medium wave station on 630 kHz now has 5 kilowatt, replacing the old 10 kilowatt transmitter. The 864 kHz frequency is no longer used, while 11760, that's the short wave frequency, is operating 24 hours a day, but there will be a reduction in the schedule shortly. Falkland Island Station, we notice this station also opening 1 hour earlier as they observe daylight time. And of course New Zealand, the international service, is heard 1 hour earlier overseas as we in New Zealand observe daylight time. And still in New Zealand, a new medium wave station, Radio Horowhenua, 1377 kHz, has been granted a commercial licence and will be operating next year, while Radio for the Print Handicapped, a test broadcast from the Christchurch area, is expected to take place in May on the occasion of the triennial conference of the New Zealand Association of the Blind. Vanuatu, 3945 and 7260, heard now with English news, now they are on daylight time at 0800 to 0817. Then the station continues and closes at the much later hour of 1020 UTC. And here's Radio Vanuatu's interval signal and the commencement on the English news at 0800. That was Radio Vanuatu with the new time of the English broadcast, 0800 UTC, now that they are on daylight time. In China, Beijing has moved to a new channel, and the broadcast in English 0830 to 0925 and 0930 to 1025 are now on 9700, 11755 and 15440 kHz, which is the new frequency. Indonesia, Jakarta, 11790, noted with English to closing at 0900. Philippines, FEBC using a new channel of 15350 to the South Pacific with news in English at 0830. The ordinary channel, which has been operated for several years, 11890 kHz, is still in use, and here's part of the announcement prior to the English broadcast at 0830 from FEBC Manila.
Available from FEBC Radio International.
That was FEBC Manila. The frequency of 15350 is a new one and heard with news in English, and the time is 0830 UTC. Taiwan, WYFR, and using the outer band channel of 7310 kHz, and this one heard opening at 1110 UTC, and we can follow it through to closing at 1625, and the broadcasts are in Mandarin.
Thanks, Arthur. And here in cold, crisp Oberpfaffenhofen, near Munich in West Germany, teams of technicians are busy pulling down cables, TV decor and dismantling antennas. For the last 7 days, this sleepy village has been the control centre for the Spacelab D1 mission, which landed safely last night at Edwards Air Force Base. It's been fascinating to follow the flight from a communications point of view. For part of each of the 112 orbits, there was no communication with the Space Shuttle Challenger, because there are not enough communication satellites yet in orbit to relay the conversations to the ground. Because the links have been so complex, the accents of some of the German scientists here at the Oberpfaffen Control Center has made it difficult for the crew to understand.
Mention, if it is impossible to understand, I suggest he tries it once more in the mother language. Perhaps I can understand him then, over.
And when you're concentrating hard in English, like Dutch astronaut Vuba Ockels up there in space, sometimes you can't even recognize your own language.
And Spacelab 201 on air to ground 1 for Vuba. Okay, goedemiddag meneer. And will you confirm that you have the sled still sitting in X-axis configuration?
I did not copy the first part of your sentence. Say again.
Okay, first part of the sentence was goedemiddag meneer.
Please repeat.
Okay, it was good day, sir, in Dutch.
Meanwhile, amateurs on the ground have been using their own methods to contact the spacecraft.
Delta Foxtrot 0, Victor Romeo. Delta Foxtrot 0, Victor Romeo.
Don't panic.
Thousands of amateur radio operators have been shouting up on 70 centimetres to the spacecraft in the hope that their call sign will be noted by a recording device on board the shuttle. Latest reports indicate that the German Amateur Radio Society will have some 20 microcassettes to process later this month. For much of the flight, only a Morse code beacon was heard on 2 metres. The two of the astronauts, Ernst Messerschmitt and Wuber Ockels, were active for a time in between their hectic experiment schedule. Messerschmitt was behind the microphone on Thursday and Sunday.
Dear Golf, this is Stella Papasio Space Lab. How do you read?
Hello. And as reported last week on Media Network, Ockels made a propagation test on the ham radio equipment, which appeared on time as the shuttle flew over Europe on Friday.
This is Delta Papa Zero, Sierra Lima, out of space with a test of the Dutch Club Veron, Sierra Zulu Echo Zulu. Each 15 seconds, there's a three-letter code. Note the codes.
The signal was so loud, in fact, that some German amateurs thought he was a pirate and kept asking him to keep the frequency clear for the spacecraft traffic.
Keep the frequency clear. Chris, why, please?
Lima, echo, echo.
Overall, European radio operators are pleased with the results. The locations of Radio Netherlands relay stations have also been in the news. It was over our site in Madagascar last night at 16:42 UTC that the shuttle fired its engines to begin the descent back to the ground. And talking of the Earth, let me slip in the news that Radio Earth, the commercial shortwave operation, rang us here in Germany to report that they've bought a 50-kilowatt SSB transmitter that they're planning to install in the Netherlands Antilles on the island of Curaçao. According to owner Jeff White, this will be converted to a shortwave transmitter of 25 kilowatts, ready for use in about 7 months' time. Listening on the airwaves around here, I came across this sound. I wonder if you know what it is. Over 80 stations in this area are putting out that noise, all of them amateur. The system's called Packet Radio, and according to Mitch Wolfson, an American working here near Munich, this system is the future for amateur radio. Invented in Canada and further developed in Tucson, USA, it's designed to link home computers digitally over the radio. So, why call it packet radio?
Because each transmission is a packet. It's sent in a burst, and the burst has all the information within it in order to address that burst to its particular destination and ensure that the destination has received the transmission. And it's very quick. On a UHF frequency at 1200 baud, it's sent in almost every packet in well under 1 second, which is quite a bit. It's about a line and a half on your terminal.
The system is fast, and because each burst of information is checked by the receiving station, it's very reliable. It works well on VHF and UHF, but what about shortwave?
Absolutely no problem. You can switch over to shortwave at any time on 20 meters. There's a frequency commonly in use, 14103, and they do slow down. They generally run only 300 baud because of the fact that it is shortwave and cut the length of the packets down so that we still don't send more than a second or two. And the obviously range is your normal shortwave range.
If plans expand as fast as they're doing now, shortwave will become a secondary means of fast point-to-point communication between amateurs over the oceans. National links are being built up in Germany and also in Holland, some stations acting as a sort of repeater, simply receiving the packets, storing them for a few moments, and then putting them out again on the same frequency, but of course much stronger. Some stations also have the facility to put the packets they receive out on shortwave or up to the orbiting amateur radio satellites. Towards the end of this decade, a device called PackSat will be launched from the space shuttle. This will orbit the Earth about once every 90 minutes. It will then be possible to send a message up to PackSat, let's say from Holland, intended for a ham radio operator in Japan. When the satellite passes over that country, the information is then downloaded. To get started, you obviously need a transmitter and receiver, plus a license to operate them. a home computer, and something to go in between. That's called a terminal node controller. How much does that cost?
Okay, cost, if you would like to build your own, an excellent system now being sold is the terminal node controller from the TAPR I mentioned earlier, Tapper, the Tucson Amateur Packet Group in Arizona. They are selling a kit which costs $175 US plus $10 US shipping, and overseas would have to be quoted separately. And this kit is extremely sophisticated. The current version is very, very small, is almost virtually CMOS, runs off at 12 volts, and is very, very sophisticated.
Of course, you need construction experience to be able to assemble that. On the other hand, you can also choose a simpler but more restricted system, simply using a computer and the transceiver. So, which computers can do this?
There are versions available for the TRS-80, the Commodore 64, the Apple II. The latter are here in Germany, very, very popular, and were developed here in Germany, at least the versions I've seen. And recently announced in the States was a new version of a Commodore 64 combination modem and plug-in module with software for the by the company AEA, which stands for Advanced Electronic Applications. And this particular little box will plug into your Commodore 64 and enable not only packet operation, but also ASCII, BODO, mTOR, and CW.
So certainly the horizons seem to be opening. Is it all happening, though, in the United States? I mean, is there much European input?
Well, to now in Europe, no, I'd have to really say in Germany we've been following more than leading. What we are doing in Germany, however, is working on the RUDOC project, which is the packet radio part of the OSCAR Phase 3C satellite that's due to go up next year, which will have a packet radio transponder. And that transponder is being built here in Munich and is being tested and software being written for it.
And having seen a demonstration here yesterday, I must say the enthusiasm for this new system is refreshing, especially as ham radio has been going through the doldrums in many parts of the world. But with the popularity of modems, why not simply link two computers via the telephone and forget about radio?
Well, for one thing, everybody looks for a challenge. And telephone is, you pick up the number, you dial somebody else, you got to know who to call. You can only talk to this person. This person can only offer you so much. Part of the beauty of amateur radio is that there's literally millions of amateurs out there, or potential amateurs, who can also get on packet radio. You don't know who you're talking to or going to be talking to, and you may find something very much in common with a person and find that this person's also running the same computer you are, and you may want to trade some software. You may want to talk more about it. It opens up a lot more opportunity. Plus the fact that it really doesn't cost anything. Once you've invested in the hardware, it's an absolute great way of connecting a home computer hobby with an amateur radio hobby. And there may be a number of people that never even thought about amateur radio who would be absolutely enjoying packet radio.
Okay, it's nice to introduce a new subject, but where can you send people who are interested in further information? Obviously, we can't cover everything here.
That is very, very true, and I really recommend that people do contact directly the Tucson Amateur Packet Radio Group, which is at the following address, P.O. Box 22888. I repeat, P.O. Box 22888, Tucson, Arizona. That's T-U-C-S-O-N, Arizona, 85734 in the United States.
That was Mitch Wolfson, bringing to an end this edition of Media Network, this time from southern Germany. Next week, we'll be back in Hilversum, and maybe in a couple of years, one of us here, including my colleagues at the Dutch Domestic Radio Service, the NOS, who've helped us this past week, maybe one of us will make it into space in 86, because NASA announced on Tuesday that a journalist will be given a chance to fly in the shuttle. I wonder what the D-1 crew would think about having one of us go.
And I know all of us on board certainly wish you could be with us too. It's just as much fun as it was for you.
Well, who knows? Bye for now.
Contributions to Media Network, Box 222, Hilversum, the Netherlands.
Some stations talk to the world. Radio Netherlands talks to people.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website.
This is Media Network with Jonathan Marks,
where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
I regret to inform you this recording is now officially over.